according to Luke. Now on that same day, two of the disciples were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty of deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? Then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all of the scriptures. As they came near the village which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going away. But they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?' That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered there. They were saying, 'The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread." The Gospel of our Lord.
So in these two lessons, we have examples of how the scriptures rewrite themselves and retell the story and reinterpret starters from the Acts of the Apostles when Peter gets up, and this is shortly after the scene in chapter 1 of what we refer to as Pentecost, the visitation of the Spirit, and Peter says, "You who crucified Jesus." Boom, right off the bat. And Christian fundamentalism is born, which, as a matter of fact, has nothing to do with the heart of the gospel whatsoever. And you know, we can only guess that by the middle of the second century, the Common Era, when both the Gospel according to Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, Acts being the sequel, right, to the Gospel according to Luke, that the story's already being rewritten. But if you go back to the story that Luke has already told, oddly enough, it wasn't those Jewish people gathered with Peter that that crucified Jesus. That would, oh, gee whiz, be the Roman Empire. So, do you see how the story gets changed as they go? And then my other favorite one, and boy, this is just kind of ramping up in the Acts of the Apostles, when in response to Peter's message of guilt, shame, and fear, 3,000 are baptized. There probably weren't even 3,000 people living in the city of Jerusalem at the time in the first century of the Common Era. But again, the message is clear. You know, if you don't keep score and keep up the numbers, then you too can feel shameful and guilty. And it gets better as the Acts of the Apostles goes. Next time around, I think 10,000 are baptized. And then, the numbers just keep growing and growing. I mean, there wasn't even a population on the planet that would support that kind of claim, interestingly enough. And yet, there it is. And so, again, what's the old adage? The victor rewrites the history, or something like that? Well, here's a really good example. And then, even going back now, into the story, the first act, if you will, the Gospel according to Luke, when right at the tail end of this fabulous story that we refer to as the Road to Emmaus, the author tells us, and when Jesus appeared to Peter, really? Show me in the story, show me when that happened. It doesn't. They're already changing the story. And this is how Scripture interprets Scripture. We talk about this in the various Bible classes that we run here. And it's pretty standard stuff, right? And it's amazing how the story, you know, gets changed. Because, as a matter of fact, who Jesus appears to is the women, right? Okay. So, back to the heart of the story. We have this wonderful, wonderful scene. Now, in order to get in touch with it and then to expound on it, there are three spiritual axioms, if you will, that came to mind as I perused this particular story, one of my favorites in the Gospels, And these come out of the recovery community, so if you're familiar with recovery, you'll recognize these right away. Three things: awareness, acceptance, and action. Okay? And typically, one of the things I've discovered about myself is that I'm very quick to jump from awareness to action. Bam!
Say it's not so.
Does this sound familiar? I know, huh? I could stop right there, couldn't I? Except that would kind of leave us with the bad news. We're heading for the good news, right? Yeah, I know. It sounds like some of you can identify with this, you know. So, some problem is identified or some situation, some relationship, whatever it happens to be, we become aware of it. Boom, give me a solution. Bam, right into action, right? And we skip over acceptance. So, here's, and we'll come back to that in a bit, but here's how I want to invite us to enter into the story. Think back in your life to a point in time of desolation. This could be any point in time in your life, from the birth of a stillborn child to a miscarriage to the announcement of the death of a loved one, or sitting bedside and a loved one finally dies, or a doctor announces some serious illness or condition prior to which you were not aware. you know, your favorite baseball team loses the World Series. I mean, and yeah, New Englanders would identify with that. They're crazy, rabid fans. I mean, they're scary. I mean, that for them would be a point in time of desolation, you know, losing the World Series. But it could be anything that just slams us to the earth, anything that crushes the life out of us, crushes our spirit. That point in time, that kind of point in time of just utter desolation. You got one? I'll bet you everybody in this room's got one. At least one. Yeah, probably a whole series of them. Okay, now, hold that image and realize that that's exactly where these people coming out of Jerusalem toward this, what may very well be this fictional place. Archaeologists have yet to identify the town of Emmaus. They don't have a clue where it is. They think it's somewhere in the north, but it still remains a mystery. And so this place they're traveling toward, but what they're carrying with them is this utter desolation. They are crushed. The person that they've put all their faith, all their time, all their energy, all their resources, everything they have, and have given it over, is dead and gone, and it's over. Whatever their expectation was, it's over, and they are crushed. So far, so good? Okay. And as they're trudging, perhaps crawling for all we know, they begin to have a conversation with a stranger. And one of the first things the stranger says is, "Talk to me. Tell me what's going on. What's up?" And they begin to speak. And what they speak is their desolation. And you know as well as I that when we begin to talk about our desolation, that point in time of desolation that we would just as soon sweep under the rug, to speak of it makes it worse, doesn't it? Which is why we want to sweep it under the rug in the first place. And here they are, and this stranger is drawing their story out of them, speaking of their desolation. And it's gone from bad to worse now. And then the stranger begins to share in their desolation and speak of their desolation in a bigger context, in a wider context, bringing in their scriptures, being the Hebrew scriptures, the Jewish scriptures, and talking about their desolation from the vantage point of their ancient story. The suggestion being that this point in time of desolation is not the only one. They are not alone. Which doesn't make it any better. I mean, it's gone from bad to worse, and the more they talk, the worse it gets, until finally, it's evening, time to stop, and somehow, these people who are on the road find it within themselves to extend a little kindness to this stranger. I mean, they're choking so hard right now, and yet they turn to the stranger and say, "You know what? Stay. Stick around. We don't know why. Because this isn't helping much any, really. But please stay." And the stranger does. And then extend further hospitality and kindness by including the stranger in their evening meal. And no sooner do they sit down than the stranger takes blesses, breaks, and gives them bread. And in that moment, they recognize him. And then, he's gone. Now, who wants to guess why they recognize Jesus, now the risen Christ, when he takes, blesses, breaks, and gives? Why do they recognize him? Anybody? Because they've seen, this is the gospel according to Luke, and remember, we've joked about this, you can describe Jesus in the gospel according to Luke as the one who is sharing a meal, leaving a meal, looking for a meal, or talking about a meal. I mean, that's the gospel according to Luke in a nutshell. And without saying a word, you know, specific to himself, he engages in the activity that he's engaged all along, and it's like, oh my God, it's him. And then he's gone. Now, again, for the wider context, the table fellowship or the sharing of meals that Jesus engages in is also very similar to what's happening in this scene, because the people that Jesus gathers with, and he's like this heat-seeking missile, and he finds people who, in the first century, the Common Era, are experiencing a point in time of utter desolation. The catchphrase in Luke's gospel is, and the accusation is, he eats with tax collectors and sinners. Now, those are all people in the first century of the Common Era who are exiles in their own lives, in their own land. They are cut off from life as they know it. Nobody wants them around. They are shunned. They are shoved aside. They are forgotten. They are desolate. And those are the people Jesus shares meals with. And so the other reason that these folks on the road to Emmaus recognizes him is because now they are among the desolate. So, there's an awareness that is beginning to grow among them. And if they're like me, they're going to want to get right into action. Give me a solution. We've got the problem. Now, let's fix it. Now. Right? I see that sounds familiar. Okay. Well, but in the ancient tradition, and again, from the vantage point of the recovery community, there's some deep wisdom that we miss when we jump from awareness to action, and it's the step in between called acceptance. So we celebrated Easter. It was fabulous, and we were exhausted, and I wanted to be done. You know what I mean? Like finished. He is risen. Now leave me alone. You know, I'm tired. And so I stopped reading this book, the Book of Joy, once again given to me by my fabulous, brilliant, lovely, talented, deeply spiritual wife, Marietta, who's sitting over there somewhere. I just stopped. I was tired. I stopped reading. It's like, oh, my God, the Book of Joy. Enough already. Please. I've had enough joy. I've had it right up to here, right? I don't want to read it. So I did. I just stopped reading. I didn't take it to San Francisco when we went to horse around for a couple of days after Easter. I left it at home. I didn't even look at it. I just sort of shoved it to the back of my stack of books. And then it started talking to me, like things do. And I picked it up again this week, reluctantly. And lo and behold, where's the bookmark? This is on page 223, so I've still got about 80 pages to go in this book. Chapter 4 in this section, the title of which is Acceptance. The subtitle, The Only Place Where Change Can Begin. And once again, the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, these two smart alecks who are constantly poking fun of themselves at each other and the rest of us. They're going on and on. And then out of their mouths and out of their hearts come these really stunning things. And to open this chapter, the Dalai Lama posits this series of questions. Why be unhappy about something if it can be remedied? Followed by, and what is the use of being unhappy if it cannot be remedied? I wanted to put the book back down again. But it goes on, as you can imagine. And then he's talking, once we see life in its wider perspective, once we're able to see our role in its drama with some degree of humility, which they've already talked about, and once we're able to laugh at ourselves, which they've been doing all along in this book, then we come to the fourth and final quality of mind. Apparently there are four. I can't remember the other three. I mean, that's why books were invented, for people like me that can't remember, which is the ability to accept our life in all its pain, imperfection, and beauty. And then the Dalai Lama goes on to say, acceptance, by the way, is the opposite of resignation and defeat. Let me read that again. Acceptance is the opposite of resignation and defeat. And then it goes on. And right away, I mean, as soon as I hear that, I realize, oh my God, you know, once I've gotten to that point of awareness, whatever this point in time of desolation may be, I'm now aware of it. The example that came to mind was at the age of 30, I'm already ordained a couple of years, you know, inflicting my ego on whatever congregation, I get slammed to the earth, I begin to awaken to life as it really is, and one of the things that begins to surface for me at the age of 30, for God's sake, is the physical, emotional, and verbal abuse that I grew up with as a kid. And how it stole my life from me. I'm 30 years old, really? I mean, come on. You know, move on, right? I become aware of it at that point in my life, and of course, wham, I want to go right in, we're going to fix this. I'm going to change my family. Or I'm going to start wishing for a better past. Or, you know, whatever. I mean, all the crazy ideas that you and I come up with when we're finally confronted with that point in time of desolation in our lives. And what I've had the opportunity to learn is that before action comes acceptance. And what the Dalai Lama said, in all its pain and imperfection and beauty, and that acceptance is not resignation or defeat, which is the other response. Okay, if there's no action, then I just give up. Screw it all. You can have it, blah, blah, you know. And I'll just become apathetic, which, by the way, I discovered I'm really, really good at. Almost master level apathetic. And that's not what acceptance is, correct? Once that awareness arises, what is required of us is this massive, depending on the thing, whatever that point in time of desolation may be, but if it's a heavy one, if it's one that has sort of controlled, you know, taken over our lives and affected everything that we do or say, now it's going to require massive, massive amounts of time and psychic and spiritual energy, not to speak of physical energy, just to begin to accept it. And then, of course, the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop go on, and I kept reading, going, please stop, please, no. But I kept reading, and they even go as far as, you know, the acceptance of relationships, people that have done us harm. And at one point, the Dalai Lama says, ah, yes. He says, you must not hate those who do harmful things. The compassionate thing, there it is. The compassionate thing is to do what you can to stop them, for they are harming themselves as well as those who suffer from their actions. And then both of them, both the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop, then begin to make reference to what the next section is going to be. I really want to lose this book now, right now, so I don't have to keep reading. Dick, you want to like borrow it and then we can forget you have it or something? Because now the next few sections are going to be talking about these are sort of the virtues of the mind, as it were, ending with and culminating in acceptance. And now the next ones are going to be, you know, the virtues of the heart, the things that you and I talk about, like compassion, forgiveness, you know, mercy, all that fun stuff. And so, you know, here we are on the road with those friends of Jesus who are, they're desolate. And they experience him in a meal that they've shared with him probably hundreds of times. And here's the heart of the gospel, folks. Now, again, I mentioned earlier, it's stunning. I mean, the more I read the scriptures, the more I wrestle with the scriptures, like wrestling an alligator, the more time I spend with the scriptures, I'm stunned at how quickly those ancient authors began to retell the story and re-spin it in a different way, you know, to the point where, you know, Jesus' death becomes a ransom, a blood sacrifice that God demands, right? And I just have to say it once again that I fired that God years ago, not interested, right? And if that God is still a part of your life, give yourself permission to fire that God and hire a new one, because ransom for sin and blood sacrifice does not lie at the heart of the gospel. It doesn't. Here's what lies at the heart of the gospel message, is that not only does Jesus meet his friends in their utter desolation, not only does he meet them there, he's been waiting for them. He has preceded them. And it may be that the reason you and I are even here right now, in this place, at this time, is that on some basic level, you and I have experienced the same thing. That Jesus and God have met us and preceded us, perhaps, in our desolation. And this, folks, this is the good news. I mean, we are not alone. Even when we feel completely alone and isolated and desolate, we are not alone. And that Jesus blesses, breaks, and gives them bread, and then poof, is gone, is an invitation both to his friends in this story and to us to do the same. You and I are invited out of our desolation to the extent that we are willing to speak it. Hey, says Jesus, talk to me. Tell me what's going on. To the extent that we're willing to speak it out loud and, oh yeah, feel it deeply, which again is the part most of us really desperately want to avoid, but to the extent that we're willing to walk that road, no pun intended, Jesus meets us in that desolation and then invites us to take, bless, break, and give. And not just bread. But think about your life and our baptism, our ministry together as followers of Jesus, as lives of taking and blessing and breaking and giving everything. A hand extended, a welcome, a compassionate moment, mercy extended to an enemy, particularly a family member. I mean, on and on it goes. Just it is endless the ways in which, out of our own desolation, you and I can take and bless and break and give. Awareness, acceptance, then action. How about fear? Good luck. If you get that over with, call me first, will you, please? It's one of those things we learn to live with, and fabulous question. And according to my spiritual director, what happens is the fear is alive and well, and it takes on many shapes and many forms, and what I was fearful of yesterday will be something else today, and it'll morph and get even smarter, you know, tomorrow, that sort of thing. And I get to live out of all of the points in time of desolation in my life in order to see that God and Jesus have been with me and us all along. And now the faithful response, not the fearful response, but the faithful response is to do what Jesus did. Take, bless, break, and give. And we can be as scared as the day is long. Nope. And God knows I've tried. Anybody else give that a whirl? How's making fear go away in your life worked out for you lately? Yeah. Yeah, it's this weird, and it's kind of it's like a balance, you know. It's like walking a tightrope or something, and you know, the question is, which way are we going to lean today? Am I going to lean into my fear? I'm going to lean into the faith. And again, here is both the beauty of the gospel and the deep and abiding wisdom of recovery, okay, both all kind of smushed together, is that as long as we stay the course on, okay, today what I get to do is be aware, you know, come to acceptance, and then, you know, be taking some action, again, not out of fear, but out of that faith that God is with us in our desolation, it's all going to kind of work itself out. To break it? I think your question is reminding me of that old adage that courage is fear that has said its prayers. So, yeah, to some extent, perhaps, it doesn't go away, but it can be, other things can take its place. It can be displaced by a life of faith. Does that make sense? Yeah. So if you're having a lot of fear, you're in real good company right here. Is that good? We good? All right. What is it again? Awareness? Acceptance? All right. Here we go. Take a nice deep breath.